This morning I'd like to comment on one of the most pithy, I would say, most wonderful pieces in the history of Zen literature. Very short, but contains, you might say, almost everything. It's by Dogen. It occurs in the Genjo Koan, which is a section of the Shobo Genzo, a great collection of, one of the collections of his works. And it goes like this. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to abandon the body and mind of self and other. And to do so is to be enlightened by all things. No trace of this enlightenment persists. And this traceless enlightenment continues forever. Since the time of the Buddha, people have interpreted the teaching of the Buddha in various ways. Buddha, of course, did not intend to found Buddhism. But it came about. And it came about for various reasons, and we don't know them all, obviously. But it resonated with people when the Buddha pointed out that enlightenment, awakening, coming to the end of suffering was possible. And moreover, well, in the Avatamsaka Sutra it states it well. The Buddha apparently said, as recorded in the Avatamsaka Sutra, "The way I see it now," he said, "all beings are endowed with Tathagata." He didn't say Buddha, because that was not the current way of speaking at the time. But he said Tathagata, which means that the gone beyond, that which has gone beyond, or the one who has gone beyond. And then he said, people don't realize this because this Tathagata is covered over with deluded thoughts and attachments. Now those two statements, the statement by Dogen and that which is found in the Avatamsaka Sutra, you might say it all. There's very little actually in the literature that you really need. What is necessary is to practice. And of course, to be inspired and guided in this appropriate practice that leads to awakening. But that these two things state the whole thing. Now, from the time of the Buddha up to the time when Bodhidharma came to China, there were all kinds of interpretations of the teachings of the Buddha. And they went through the things that religions go through. Some would pray to Buddha, some imagined that there was a pure land in the West, where if you did certain things and recited certain mantras in certain ways, that you would arrive there after death and it would be a place of great felicity. And others compared the teaching of the Buddha with that of yoga, which existed prior to the Buddha in India. And there were things about the Atman and Brahman and Brahma and equality of those things, and that there is a way to reach those and so on. And the idea of sainthood and so on, all of which was in the teaching of yoga and what was called Advaita Vedanta. And others developed kinds of rituals, and others developed ideas of progression and stages and steps. And eventually there was a lot of translation of the teachings of the recorded teachings that came about from the marvelous memory of Ananda. And you know the story that after the Buddha's death, there was a great conclave of his followers, and Ananda was blessed with a marvelous memory and was around the Buddha much of his teaching life, though Ananda did not, in the teaching life of the Buddha, come to enlightenment. He came to enlightenment after the death of the Buddha, under the guidance of the first Indian patriarch, you might say, Kashyapa. But anyhow, he had a marvelous memory, and he had memorized everything, presumably, that the Buddha had ever said in his teaching. And so they sat Ananda down and had him just spout it out. And folks were there, scribes, and they wrote it all, and after a long time, they collected, and Ananda said, I think that's about it. And so thus arose what are called the sutras. And these were studied and compared, and they were recited and so on. If you think that that memory is marvelous, you still find people in India that are able to recite the whole Mahabharata, great epic story, and the Bhagavad Gita completely and so on. They're you often pass by a school in India, an elementary school, for example. I remember in Hardwar, I passed one, and the as you went by, you'd hear the teacher in there saying a sentence, and all the little students would recite the sentence back. So kind of a responsive learning, and it came about through memorization. And this is understandable. Many of them were illiterate, and there weren't writing materials, and so on. And so the only way that they would learn things is by this process of rote memory. And that is a that has been a kind of a benefit on one side for the educational systems in certain countries. In the East, and it's also been a curse because it kind of squashes creativity and innovation and so on. But anyhow, all that is quite secondary. So the sutras arose, and Buddhism went on its way with all its different sects and interpretations and so on, having not totally forgotten, but largely forgotten, what the Abhidhamma Sutra points out, that all beings are fundamentally Buddha, fundamentally Tathagata. Yet this is covered over by deluded thoughts and attachments. Certain individuals, which was called the Dhyana folks within Buddhism, were very quiet, and they spent a lot of time meditating, and they actually had ferreted out from the teachings of the Buddha those things that were useful guidelines for the process of dispelling deluded thoughts and attachments. And so they were called the Dhyana folks because they did Dhyana, which was meditation. And when Buddhism went to China, the Chinese heard Dhyana as Chana, and they shortened that to Chan. And then as that came to Japan, Chan got to be called Zen. And then Zazen was sitting meditation. So that's a simple thumbnail of the whole history of Buddhism. So there were these people that did this work. However, it had not penetrated to many parts of the world. And still people engaged in practices that you find very prevalent today also under the guise of Buddhism. Great libraries of the sutras are present, and people take on Chinese or Japanese names, and they recite things, and they pray to Amida Buddha, and so on and so on. So Bodhidharma was the was a prime person in the Dhyana school in India, and he came from the south of India when he was about 90 to China. All of you know the story. The slow boat to China took him 3 years to get to China, and probably when he got there, his fame was spread to the emperor's palace, and the emperor Wu happened to be a real Buddhist. What's the word? He was a patron of Buddhism, and he had endowed many temples and founded monasteries and so on. And promoted the translation of sutras into Chinese and so on. So Bodhidharma was invited to the court of the Emperor Wu, and Emperor Wu, as you all know the story, had a little conversation with him and said, "Now, I've done all these things. Isn't there merit in that?" And Bodhidharma, standing before the person, namely the Emperor Wu, who had the power of life and death over anybody, said to him, "No merit whatsoever." Thus, in a sense, pulling the rug out from under all that the emperor had devoted his life to. And so the emperor, to his good credit, rather than call the swordsman, said to Bodhidharma, "Well, what is the essence of the Holy Scriptures?" And Bodhidharma said, "Vast emptiness, with nothing holy in it." And then this piqued the emperor's Wu's curiosity all the more. He had heard that this was he was the 38th, 28th, whatever it was, patriarch of Buddhism in the direct lineage from the Buddha, and so on. So, but nonetheless, these were all very mysterious comments to him. And he expected some kind of discourse when he asked, "What is the essence of the holy teachings?" And so he asked the Bodhidharma, "Who are you?" And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." That's even simpler, the way it's put in Chinese, is simply not knowing. Not knowing. Not even an I don't know, but not knowing. So, Bodhidharma, seeing that he wasn't getting a very useful response from the Emperor Wu, turned away and traveled towards the north of China to Shorin, and the Emperor Wu tried to urged his folks to call him back and have him come, but they said, "No use. He will not come back." And so Bodhidharma went and sat facing the wall repeatedly for 9 years, and had eventually 4 or 5 disciples who got it, and thus began the great beginning of the Tang Dynasty and what has been called the Golden Age of Zen, lasting to about 900 of our era. And then, of course, not stopping there, but going on through Sung. But there was such a great flourishing in Tang, great masters, and much literature that was of a different quality. It was a literature about authenticity, and it was a literature about how. It wasn't what, but it was about how. And it was greatly inspiring, and there were many interactions between the masters and their disciples and their other masters, and some of these got recorded and were used as koan and became the basis in the Sung Dynasty for Zen study. and collections were made in Sung, notably the Mumon Kan and the Hekigen Roku, and on the whole process of Zen began as it went through the world. Dogen, whom I quoted at the beginning, went to China, and he lived, by the way, from 1200 to 1253, and went to China in his 20s to study Zen. He had studied some in Japan, but went to China to encounter Zen master whom he had heard, and when he came back, they asked him what he had learned, and he said a very typically down-to-earth answer, which was, he said, "I discovered that my eyes are horizontal and my nose vertical." Well, he went on, and there was a great literature that he produced. People recorded what he had said, what he said and did, and so on. And he himself wrote some things, including which is the Genjo Koan, the collection in the collection called the Shobo Genzo. So back to our material. To study Buddhism is to study the self. In other words, as Bodhidharma pointed out to the Chinese, it is not the study of sutras. It is not the doing of rituals. It is not the empty, repetitive use of a mantra. It is rather to study the self. And that's based on the teaching of the Avatamsaka Sutra, where it points out that we are all fundamentally Tathagata, fundamentally this enlightened being, but it is covered over. What does covered over mean? Well, these are words we use. This human being that we are is very mysterious. Certain things you might say are very obvious, but certain things are quite mysterious, and they cannot be really described adequately. And it's pointless to try to spend effort to describe them. And one of them is attachment. We can all experience what attachment is and learn to recognize it. But to describe what it is, we have only to say it is a fundamental quality of being a human being. This mind that is so adept and wanting to construct a reality. We might say it is the manifestation of our fundamental divine nature, we might say. It's all you might say. Our creator nature. And we are great experts at that. We generalize and we invent theories and we try to explain everything under the sun and the moon. And we're good at it. And that has given rise to civilization, for good or ill. And there's an attachment to this. We take great pleasure in these things. We take so much pleasure, we think it is reality itself. The Buddha points out, skilled though you may be in inventing ideas of reality, they are fundamentally all ideas. And they cover over this fundamental nature that is a lot more liberating than any idea could ever be. And the things that cover it over are deluded thinking and attachment. So one has to learn in studying the self how to deal with these deluded thoughts and attachment. What is a deluded thought? Well, just to be short about it, a deluded thought is not, for example, the structure of a carburetor. It is not how to lay tile. It is not how to cultivate apple trees. It is not how to milk a cow. It is not how to do your profession, whatever that may be. These are not deluded thoughts. These are thoughts taken up with reference to a particular goal that is an expression of your particular position in the great karmic fabric. They are not deluded thoughts. They don't stop you from knowing that you're a Tathagata. What then are deluded thoughts? deluded thoughts, if we could put it in a short space, are those thoughts which separate us, those thoughts which promote division, which promote the division between ourselves and other beings, and ourselves and ourselves. Now this, of course, is speaking of something else that we cannot really describe. We cannot describe what we mean by ourselves from ourselves. It is pointless to do that. One of the reasons it's pointless is that we are experiencing it. And to describe it, we would have to step outside of this ourself and ourself, and that would be pointless, a pointless endeavor, because what the whole endeavor of Buddhism is to learn how to experience this Tathagata, this who you are, and from this experience, to live one's life free from the roots of suffering. To be, as we say, free. Then you can use freely all the non-deluded thoughts. So we don't know what attachment is. We know something about deluded thoughts. And by separating ourselves from ourselves, I mean thoughts that give rise to the self, to an idea of the self. That's to say, self-congratulation about something that one has done, for example, or self-denigration about something that one thinks one shouldn't have done, and on it goes. But they're all presupposed by this idea of a self. Commenting on other people, judging other people, the great precepts that have those wonderful verses by Bodhidharma, point out, and uniquely in Zen, I think, for example, the precept against gossip. Now, I may be insufficient in my knowledge of other religions, but I don't think there's other religions that have a precept against gossip. And the precept against gossip is fundamentally about the fact that we are acting as though we are experts about somebody else, which is ridiculous. And that we have a right to use our standards to judge other beings. Mind you, this is not evaluation of behavior. How they ride a horse, how they drive a nail, how they milk a cow. This is evaluation. We're not talking about that. We're talking about judgment, which is about a person. And that's gossip. Because it produces delusion. It ensconces us more deeply in unreality. Unreality as designating that which is not fundamentally existent as our fundamental nature of Tathagata. So covered over, so the whole practice of Zen is learning how to deal, to identify, first of all, to identify these delusive thoughts and to make them so that they are not covering us over. They are not obstructing us. They are not like a mist in front of our being that shields us from a fundamental knowing. That's another thing we don't know about. Attachment is one thing. What is attachment? It's something to be experienced, not to be described. We have to learn how to recognize it. We have to create some theory about it. Likewise, knowing. Likewise, other fundamental things about our fundamental, intimate being. Seeing, hearing. What is that? We can invent, and it's useful to invent and to investigate the optic nerve and all the channels that are involved in the process of seeing, the occipital lobe and all those things of the brain, and the ways in which those can be useful to heal people and all the rest of it. Hearing, likewise, the eighth nerve and all that. But that's not our experience. Zen is concerned with our experience, for it is in our experience, the intimacy of our experience, that we will know who and what we are, and who and what the world fundamentally is, and us are us as the world, as this one reality. Only there will we ever find that. So to study Buddhism is to study the self, to observe these things, to get hip about it, to get street smart about this mind, and to learn how to put to a place of unimportance. That is, does not attach to our being, does not cover ourselves over, does not obscure us. How do we do that? That's not the point of today's conversation, but it is the point of a lot of Zen teaching. How to do that? And just to say one thing about it, everyone knows how to do that. The problem is it is not applied by everyone in every context. There are certain things that everybody considers to be unimportant. Oh yeah, that. And what it is in one's internal experience is that whatever the that is, for example, I'll use a ridiculous example. What the Emperor Wu had for breakfast. How do I don't care. That's the Emperor Wu's breakfast. More important things in the world. Now, if you look inside of where you put that thought, you put it far away inside. It is not right in front of your face. It is not occupying your whole conscious attention. It is far away. It is small. It is dull. It is dark. It is somewhere like that. You can do that. The invitation is, do that with everything that enters the mind. Everything. Learn how to do that. And as you learn how to do that, it's not going to stop you from using those things, but it's going to give you finally an option. It's going to give you freedom. For without that freedom, you are compelled to hold in consciousness whatever thoughts enter the mind because of this attachment process. So learn how to do that. Get street smart and learn how to do that. There's a lot of helps we have in Zen for that. So to study Buddhism is to study the self. That's part of studying the self. Now to study the self, you forget the self. So one of the prime things that results from this study of the self is that the very idea of a separate self becomes totally irrelevant because it cannot be ever found. And you realize that we human beings are fundamentally crazy, fundamentally insane. By giving reality to that which has no substance, we give reality to a self. And it has no substance. Nobody has ever in the history of humanity found this self. By introspection or by any other way, all they find is identifications or a set of thoughts, feelings, memories, fantasies, sensory awarenesses, and all kinds of things inside, but no self. We are crazy. What's the definition of crazy? It's to hold as real, hold as existent, something that has no reality, that has no existence. I make that distinction between real and existent. Real means that which has an effect. So we consider someone who has a theory of the world that there are nightly visitors that come down from the moon and they fertilize the planet and that's why plants grow. We say, well, crazy idea. But we naturally want to say to such a person with a little bit of compassion, can you help me to see these beings sometime? Because is there any other trace of them? If you had to prove that to somebody, what would you do? That might further the paranoia of the person to whom you're speaking, or it would get them to finally maybe realize that if there is no proof for it, if it's just a story, maybe it doesn't exist. That is the case with the self. It is a story, useful story very often. Something that we can play and take on, we can put on the clothing of a self. For example, we can wear the appropriate garb in a particular social context that allows us access to that context. Try walking into a formal gathering naked and see what happens. So you learn, if necessary, to take on the garb of the self, of a self, many selves, rules. But you're not food. This is just clothing. Taken on now by choice. Not by compulsion because you're so hungry. And this is a fundamental thing for human beings. Human beings, in my opinion, are hungry to know the truth. That is, who they are. And that drives them to settle for things that are not it. They settle for things like their identification with their professional role or by their ethnic history or by the opinions of others or whatever it is. And yet that's not what circulates their blood or walks them. So there's lots of mysterious things about human beings. This is part of the identity, the study of the self. And most of all, to let go of the idea of the self itself. Let go of attachment to this idea. See through it. And thus, let it be quite peripheral, far, far away. It's just one of those ideas that human beings have. But it doesn't enable me to see better and hear better and know better and walk better. So, study of Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to abandon body and mind of self and others. Now this does not mean to misuse or to deny or to hurt or to be ascetic about one's body and mind, whatever. It means to abandon the idea of a separate body and mind of self and others. And in your investigation of the self, one needs to look into what really is the foundation for this idea of identification with our bodies or with a separate self, or with the separation between ourselves and some other self. Not to try to protect that belief, but to look under it, what's presupposed. What is my proof? What is my demonstration of that is actually the case? And gradually you pull the rug out from under everything that used to take a hold in one's mind and stick there and thus add to this obscurity of covering the being over from one's inherent nature as Tathagata. Abandoning the idea, the body and mind of self and other. To do this, Dogen says, is to be enlightened by all things. What does that mean? Enlightened by all things means that suddenly the world starts to appear before you in a more original nature, original self. You start to get the emanations of this one thing of which we all are, in which we all, in a manner of speaking, are participants. We're not just participants, we are it. You can participate in water when you swim in it, but this is bigger than that. It is a self-recognition in the grass, in the flower, in the bird, in the cloud. To be enlightened by all things. Now you can get a hint of this. If you look intently at something and allow, like a flower, like a blade of grass, like a little insect, and you allow to drop away. Ooh, like a watch, for example, too, anything. And allow to drop away all your associations, all your names. Remember we talked the other day about peeling off the name, peeling off all the things that cover over the original intimacy of contact with anything, be it the wind, be it a flower, be it a blade of grass, be it an insect. Allowing that to drop away, and suddenly or gradually will appear before you the thing itself. The thing itself. Takes time. Takes time. Now this is not it, quotes it. This is not enlightenment. But it is a hint. It is an emanation, a sniff. This is why Dogen can say, you will be enlightened by all things. And then he says, this enlightenment leaves no trace. Meaning that you do not succumb to the sickness of enlightenment. In Zen we have a number of different sicknesses, and one of them is the sickness of enlightenment. That is to say, this same tendency in the being to want to know the self now attaches to this enlightenment as an achievement, as an it, as a something. It is a no-thing. You cannot, by looking under all the cushions in the universe, find enlightenment, just as you could not find a self. How mysterious it is! What is waking up? What is knowing? What is seeing? What is hearing? We cannot say, but we can recognize it, and we can know it. And the touchstone of this knowing is how it transforms our being. And in Zen, in the best tradition of Zen, and that tradition is sometimes gets muddy and violated, but in the best tradition of Zen, this is validated by your teacher, that is to say, by the one who is in the same lineage all the way from Shakyamuni Buddha, and to whom has been given what is called transmission, the validation of that person's own awakening. Thus, the validation of this awakening is very important to preserve the authenticity for the sake of generations in the future. But it is traceless. It is not a thing. You can't find it. How can you find waking up from sleep? Bring me some awakening from sleep. Where is it? You cannot. But this is the great sleep. The dream of self. The dream of self and other. The dream of separation. The dream of beginning and ending. He says, this traceless enlightenment continues forever. Once you are awakened, and I have to say, if you cultivate this awakening, for the tendency is so great within ourselves, this adhesive process, this attachment that couples with the desire to know who you are will take anything, and it can, although one may have had an authentic awakening, it can be made an ornament to substantiate a self, and a pernicious self, a self that can vaunt its superiority over other people because of the acquisition of this quote great thing. And it's very unfortunate, and it's very common, and that is why once we say in Zen that once you start, once you devote yourself to it, once you come to awakening, you must continue. You must continue to cultivate this. That is why we have all the different koan. It helps an individual to cultivate this and refine out of one's being this tendency to be attached to enlightenment or anything like that as a thing. Just to produce by some kind of accretion another kind of self, illusory self, to promote once again this idea of separation between oneself and the world, oneself and others, oneself and oneself, if you want to speak in those terms. It's all experience. This does not invite some thought about finding the self and the other self and all that stuff. We're using words which were meant for a divided universe to point to something in the undivided universe. So that's what's contained in these two wonderful statements, the one from the Avatamsaka Sutra. The Buddha says, way I see it now is that all beings are fundamentally Tathagata. But they do not know it because they are, this is covered over with deluded thinking and attachment. In Dogen, roughly 1800 years later, 1700 years later, says to study Buddhism, that is to say, the fundamental teaching of this awakened being, Shakyamuni. A fundamental core that is carried by Zen, that to the exclusion of all the other stuff. Study Buddhism is to study the self. The fundamental nature of this being. To study the self is to forget the self. That is to say, to forget all these things that we have made real and substituted and covered ourselves over with. To forget the self is to abandon the idea of a separate body and mind of self and other. To do that is to be enlightened by all things. And this traceless enlightenment continues forever. How could it not? Once we are awakened to it, it is our nature. And it continues forever because it is beyond birth and death. Beyond all these stories that we make and scare ourselves with. It is just this. Oh, this just this. What is that? Just this. We'll end there today.